Training to become a surgeon can feel like training for the Olympics. Then we finish and we realize we're just adults with jobs. Life after training is an entirely different landscape. You need to get to know you. What does success mean for you? What brings you joy? What's your purpose? I'm Dr. Mel Thacker, an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and coach. I'm here to help surgeons like you rediscover themselves. Welcome to Surgeons with Purpose. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. It's the end of 2024, and so I just wanted to give you all snippets from all of the episodes that I've recorded throughout the year when I started this passion project back in, what was it, the summer. I included all of the episodes except for the first two. The first two are imposter syndrome and anxiety. And I really want you guys to go back and listen to both of those through their entirety, because I think they just have so many gems and I want them to kind of stand alone as two very core foundational episodes. But you will get little snippets of every other podcast that I did this year. So without further ado, enjoy and happy new year. It's going to be a great 2025. But the reason why shame is so powerful, why it motivates us, is because it threatens death. It doesn't threaten physical death. It threatens something way worse for us. It threatens emotional death. It is so deeply embedded. As I said, it doesn't take the form of language. It's not somebody that says like, hey, you're doing that wrong. Stop it. No, it's a grunt. It's a tone of voice. It's a facial expression, a gesture, an eye roll. And shame occurs in every single culture. There isn't a culture that doesn't have it. And no wonder that public speaking is the number one fear of humans. Because when we are public speaking, we are standing directly square in the judging eyes of all of the people in the audience. And so we are risking both emotional death and social death when we public speak. And that's why it is so terrifying for us. It's even more scary than actually dying. The irony of shame is that when we fear abandonment in society, when our efforts to fit in with culture, like we're exerting effort to just fit in, we are actually deserting our true nature. So we abandon ourselves, we abandon our true nature in order to fit in with society. And that's the irony of shame, because I love how Brené Brown brings this up. How belonging and fitting in are complete opposites. There's actually this article in the JAMA that was published in like the 1920s that I found that was called, I think, Martyrs of Medicine. And it's all about these physicians, these scientists in chemistry and bacteriology and toxicology and et cetera, but who studied and died from illnesses like yellow fever and like the bubonic plague. I mean, they died young. You know, they did it knowing that they could contract the disease and die from it, and they did it anyway. I mean, that's wild to me. And then there's, of course, Marie Curie, who discovered radium and whatever other radioisotope and just like bathed herself in radioactivity for so long that she was like glowing and dying of leukemia and ultimately succumbed to leukemia. I mean, these are people who essentially martyred themselves for medicine, for science. And I mean, what kind of precedent is that setting? I know when I took the MCAT, I did not think I was giving my life to the profession. It was not about giving my life for this higher calling. I simply decided that it was something that I was really into, and I loved the idea of helping people. I never thought I had to give up my physical life. And I never thought I had to give up a portion of my life for the rest of my life. Sure, I was willing to sacrifice or martyr myself for a period of time, but not forever, not until the end of my existence. And you know, that very beautifully kind of helps me pivot into just how much we have to martyr ourselves during training, because we do martyr ourselves in training. We all know this very well, right? There's a quote that I found from this physician, Dr. Stephen Klasko, in a Forbes article that's titled, What Doctors Aren't Learning in Medical School and Why It Matters. And this quote goes, after 7 to 12 years of medical education, today's young physician has joined a cult centered around four biases: competitive, autonomous, hierarchical, and non-creative. This happens because medical schools in the US still accept medical students based on their science GPA. ability to memorize organic chemistry formulas, and MCAT scores. Yet we are amazed that doctors are not more empathetic, communicative, or creative. We still believe that a student with a 3.9 GPA will be a better doctor than one with a 3.5 GPA, even though the former may have had no social life. We are sent this culty message to martyr ourselves for the profession from the get-go. Like, we start in college by sacrificing our needs to graduate as rock stars at the top of our class, to ace the MCAT. Then in med school, we sacrifice ourselves to fill up our brains with as much knowledge as we can and to ace steps 1 and 2. And that happened when I started to have panic attacks at work. That was essentially my body grabbing me and saying, like, you can't ignore this. You have to do something about this. And so the way that these panic attacks presented themselves, I'll give you a day in the life back in early 2021. We'll do a day in my life. I would get up, obviously very tired in a fog, and I would have to go to work. And I'd have maybe 2 or 3 hours of sleep. I'd be spinning in anxiety, feeling sorry for myself, feeling awful, racking my brain over how I was going to find a solution to my problem. Even considering going to England and seeing a sleep specialist there and trying some new medication that I guess we couldn't get in the US. Then I would drive to work, listening to some sort of anti-anxiety podcast, trying to understand my anxiety and figure out how to work through it. Sometimes crying, sometimes not. And then I would get to clinic. But then I would just move through the world as like a shell of myself, like in this fog, just very little observational awareness. I started to become very afraid and paranoid. Everything scared me. If I saw a patient on my clinic schedule for a post-op, I was terrified that there was going to be a complication for that patient. No indication that that patient would have a complication, but my brain would tell me that that patient was going to have a complication, and I would have a physical reaction in my body as if they were. And I would just wish and pray, please, please, please let this patient be happy. And when they were fine, I would be like, oh, thank goodness. I went from someone who consistently thought patients are dangerous, and that thought caused dread, terror, anxiety, and panic in me, to a person who thinks patients have no ability to harm me. No one hurts me. The only person that can hurt me is me. And that's why it's so important to be aware of our emotions, to recognize them, acknowledge them, validate them, and honor them. What a lot of us do instead, though, is that we feel an emotion and then we add another negative emotion on top of it. We layer negative emotion on top of negative emotion, and it just compounds it. So we're feeling anxious, and then we get anxious about our anxiety. We're feeling frustrated, and we get frustrated about our frustration, or we get angry about our anger or annoyed about our annoyance. And another emotion we tend to layer on top of negative emotions is shame, which I've spoke about in a previous episode. And the root of shame is the word cover. And so we layer that on. We just cover up all of the negativity with shame. We tell ourselves like there's something wrong with us. We are flawed. And we create all of this unnecessary suffering as opposed to just allowing an emotion, honoring it, and just feeling it and processing it all the way through to the other end. This is something that Stephen Hayes, who is the author of a book called The Liberated Mind, calls dirty pain. No other animal other than humans, other than us, creates dirty pain. All pain and every other animal for every other animal is clean pain. And I'll give you an example. So clean pain would be if I slapped you in the face and you felt the sting of that slap, that would be the clean pain. Like, ouch, I slapped you in the face. Why did I slap you in the face? Like, maybe I'm having a bad day. Maybe you remind me of somebody that angers me. I don't know. I wouldn't slap you, I promise you. But this is just theoretical. So maybe my slapping you in the face has nothing to do with you, but you might create dirty pain by thinking thoughts like, why did she slap me? Like, do I have a super slappable face? Why would someone slap me? Like, what's wrong with me? Does everyone hate me? Everyone hates me. I knew it. So that's dirty pain, right? And so humans are the only animals that feel dirty pain, and it causes us so much suffering, and we do it with our thoughts. And it often comes from attaching meaning to something that may not have anything to do with us, that may not be any of our business, but we could be triggered into dropping into one of our limiting beliefs, that we have about ourselves. Like, I'm not worthy, or people hate me, or I'm not good enough, or what's wrong with me, or I'm deeply flawed, something along those lines, right? Something that has to do with imposter syndrome and perfectionism type beliefs. How much do they trust you? What are their anxieties? How well do they follow directions? Do they have healthy or unhealthy lifestyle habits? How do they deal with stress, pain, uncertainty, and the relinquishing of control, which is essentially what happens under surgery, right? You're like, oh, I trust you. Just put me to sleep and make me stop breathing, and I trust that I'll wake up. Those are all unknown unknowns that we cannot uncover and understand unless we get to know the person in front of us and we talk to them and we see them human to human and we ask the right questions. And once we have the unknown unknowns and we're like, okay, I got this person. I've focused on getting these unknown unknowns. I'm not just going to live in the known knowns, which are biased, limited, and incomplete. Then we can make an informed decision. We can have a shared decision-making conversation. When we live in known knowns, we blind ourselves. Known knowns are meant to guide, but not blind us. And when we talk to patients in known knowns, they don't feel seen or heard. Okay. So this is just so essential. Again, I'm going to get into this a little bit deeper in the next podcast, but I just wanted to introduce this here. And the reason why is because it directly informs whether we have belief in the surgery we're about to perform and whether we have belief in the patient we're about to perform that surgery on, to get that triad: belief in self, belief in surgery, belief in the patient. Like, the physician can almost lose trust in themselves when they focus on all of the red swans, on everything that could go wrong, and they have an emotional reaction in their body as if it were actually happening. Similarly, as an ENT surgeon, and if you're an ENT surgeon, you've probably had that moment where you're doing a tonsillectomy and all of a sudden the mouth just like fills with blood. And for a second, you're like, oh my God, I've hit the carotid. And of course, that's a red swan, right? It exists in our brain. We're having an emotional reaction. We're having a fight or flight response as if it were true, but it's not really happening. Three businesses: your business, other people's business, and the universe's business. You only have agency in your business. Okay, so try to stay there as often as you can. I challenge you to start to notice, to have an awareness how often you find your brain wanting to be in other people's business and wanting to be in the world's business, in the universe's business, and wanting to take circumstances and manhandle them and control them exactly to your liking. And then think about how freeing it would be if you didn't go there. If you dropped back into your own business, asked yourself, where do I have control? Where do I have agency? You start to decide to create your own autonomy, freedom, safety, and love. And you stop trying to meddle into everyone else's business. And again, I'm not saying that you don't take action in service to your patients. You 100% do. But in your brain, you don't make it mean anything about you. Some really good examples, obviously, from residency would be a good one. Instead of seeing the people who maybe didn't treat you so well if you were in a toxic program, what if you could see them as challengers who show you what you value? Let's say you value not subscribing to vertical hierarchies. Perhaps you would not have known that unless you were subjected to a toxic residency that tried to put a vertical hierarchy on you. I mean, that was the experience I had. Before I went into residency or before I got into medical school, I wasn't like thinking about, hey, do I value vertical hierarchies? No, I don't. Yeah, I really got clear on that after I went through that experience. Another good example is whether you value autonomy and freedom. And so I realized I value both of those a lot after I took a job in academia. And I was in that job for 2 years and I was like, get me out of here. I feel suffocated by all of the administrators and the levels of bureaucracy. Like, I don't like this. I don't like people telling me what to do. But I didn't realize that until I entered that job. Another good thing to question and what you value is like martyrdom. Like, I didn't realize that I think martyrdom is a crock of shit and I don't value that at all whatsoever. And I think that narrative is very harmful, but I did not realize that until I was subjected to the culture of the martyrdom message. And so I could look at all the people who are like screaming martyrdom from the rooftops and be like, oh, like they're awful, they're villains. But no, I'm just like, thank you, you challenged me, and now I know what I value. I think some of the best surgeons, some of the best doctors are both things. They are both strategically disconnected and then very connected. They live in connection, but they're able to move out of it. And they show up with the intention to create the most 100% perfect result for their patient. And they know that that's an impossibility, so that when it doesn't happen, they don't beat themselves up and make themselves feel unworthy or awful or self-punish. And so if you have an awareness of these duality concepts, it really becomes useful for you in how you approach the world as a surgeon. Emotions live in the body, and emotions are information. Our emotions are basically talking to us, and they do not talk to us with language. They talk to us with energy, with vibrations. We're always getting information from our body, and if we're able to pay attention to it and listen to it, we open up this space of opportunity of stepping into emotional wealth. And it's funny because you can think of emotions as almost like the president of your system, because they have veto power. So you might think you can reason with your emotions. You can say, for example, if you're feeling anxious and overwhelmed and you're in fear over a surgery that you're about to do, you're not really sure why, you could think the thoughts like, what the hell? Like, I'm a learned doctor. I'm not supposed to be scared. I shouldn't be scared. Let me just reason with this feeling and suppress it and push it down and tell it it's not supposed to be there. That doesn't get you anywhere, because guess what? Your emotions have veto power, and they're going to be like, listen, we're in fight or flight, bitch. Like, I don't care what kind of reasoning you have or what kind of logic you're presenting or the fact that you've been doing this for 10 years. Like, we're scared. And so you have to kind of like think of your emotions as these very powerful parts of you that you cannot use your smart, logical, accomplished brain to figure out and to convince. The only way to get through an emotion is to honor them. It's really important for you to get very clear on what your core values are. So I'll share some of my core values with you. My core values are authenticity, transparency, honesty, presence, congruency, trustworthiness, service, health, human connection, creativity, curiosity, humility, and beginner's mind or don't know mind. That is the foundation of my house, of my identity. And the reason it's so important to get clear on your core values is all based in science. There's plenty of studies that support the importance of reflecting on your core values. The Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences actually had a paper by Emily Falk from the University of Pennsylvania that talks about this. So she used fMRI to see what would happen in people's brains when they were presented with change that was seen as challenging. So like, for example, someone who's never exercised before was told like, you have to go on this exercise program like tomorrow. Or someone who's been a smoker their whole life was told like, we're taking your cigarettes away tomorrow. Okay. And so they looked at people's brains with fMRI when they were given these challenging changes. And they found that if you reflect deeply on your core values, that showed heightened neural activity in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And that part of our prefrontal cortex is associated with positive valuation or seeing threats as manageable changes, manageable challenges. And so when we are presented with like a big uprooting of our life, like a pandemic, for example, when something that changes really drastically, when we can reflect on our core values, it gets us very grounded. And that's why I love seeing our core values as like the foundation of our house, because we're like, oh, that's okay that this big change is coming, because I know what is true for me and I'm going to ground myself in that. I'm going to ground myself in my commitment to always being authentic and transparent and honest and present and trustworthy and showing up in service and honoring my health and having human connections and being creative and being curious and being humble and always showing up with don't know mind. So if I'm always like grounding myself in that, if a huge change is thrown at my life, I can meet it and just be like, oh, this isn't going to completely derail me. Like, I can actually face this change and manage and get through, get to the other side and actually maybe even grow from it, maybe even come out a better person. And so that, I think, is what we falsely view as confidence. We think confidence leads to doing unethical things to patients. And I want to be very clear that confidence is not cavalier or carelessness. It is not narcissism. It's not egoism. It's not God complex. It's very separate. And just because those archetypes of surgeons are confident doesn't mean that we can't develop confidence and be humble and think the thought, I love and approve of myself independent of surgical outcomes. Our language matters. I mean, how common is it for a teacher or a parent to say like, oh, little Johnny, you hurt Timmy's feelings, right? You need to apologize for hurting Timmy's feelings. Or that hurt mommy's feelings. That's another one. Even when I was in the throes of anxiety and depression around 2021, I remember having some sort of emotional reaction where I was having thoughts in my brain that were creating anxiety for me. And while I was having that anxious moment, like an anxiety attack, I must have been making a face or emoting in some way. And I remember my son saying to my daughter, like, Nora, you're scaring mama. And at that moment in time, I was like, oh my God, I cannot demonstrate to my children, I cannot model to my children that they have the ability to make me feel a certain way. Like, no, Colin, Nora is not scaring mama. Mama can only scare herself with her own thoughts. To turn your anxiety, reframe your anxiety into excitement. And so you can say that. You can be like scrubbing at the scrub sink and you feel all of those like sensations in your body of anxiety. And then you're like, okay, heart is racing, palms are sweating, vibrations are high. All right, pits are sweating, starting to sweat through my scrubs. And you can be like, wow, I must be really excited to do this surgery, okay? Because you are skilled enough to do it. Like, you are board certified. You've gone through all the training. You've graduated from your program. You have all of the credentials. You are an expert in your field. Just part of you is feeling anxious because it wants to keep you safe. And so unless you accept those sensations and love that side of you and be like, thank you. Thank you for trying to keep me safe. But in fact, this is going to be fun. This surgery is going to be amazing. And we're going to help this patient because we're showing up with a giver's heart. And then you go through and you're like, yep, I did that. Okay. Yep. I definitely saw that critical structure. Yep. It was intact. Yep. That was okay. Okay. Everything went well. And now you can add that piece to the puzzle of your jigsaw. So you have the little bit of information, whatever it is that you get from your medical assistant or nurse, like the patient has a fever, abdominal pain, or the patient is bleeding, or that post-op thing is happening, some badness is happening. And then you get the other puzzle piece that you put into your jigsaw puzzle in your brain from what happened during the surgery. And you're getting that objectively. You know for certain what happened intraoperatively. And so you have this incomplete puzzle. And when you have that incomplete puzzle, now you're like, okay, I have an incomplete puzzle. And now I am a fact finder. I need to get curious. I am on a mission to gather information. I'm a data collector.
Trying to simplify practice. Mm-hmm. And something that I hear a lot is there's just such a rush throughout the day because you're seeing so many patients. And a question I always ask is like, does it have to be like this?
Yeah.
And I'm surprised by how often the answer is no. It's like, well, why do you see 32 patients a day? Well, it's just like how my scheduler books me.
Yeah.
Well, who controls your scheduler? Like the office manager. Well, who's the boss of the office manager? Well, actually, I kind of am as a partner.
Yeah.
Well, what would happen if you see 26 patients a day? Well, access would go down. Well, you know, you're fixing people's ankles and yeah, like you break your ankle, you want surgery, but is it that big of a deal if someone has to wait a week, if that means you don't burn out? And just getting someone from 32 patients a day to 26 patients a day or 28. Mm. And then just having that hour that then still gets spaced out along the day, but then you're not always running behind. You're not always stressed. If someone needs 24 minutes with you instead of 20, you can give them that 24 minutes. But making that initial cut back feels like so hard. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. Like there's so much anxiety about it.
Yeah.
And then 2 months later, it's like, oh my God, why haven't I had a schedule of 26 patients for the last 10 years? Yeah. No one's burning down the door saying the access sucks. So it's making those initial changes and then staying consistent, which again is just, that's just behavior change. Humans are human.
Guys, this is so common. I knew tons of guys like this. This is like the old guy move for attendings. They're always like at a party. They're trying to rustle up some tea, get the people going. And so just the, hey, let me tell you a story about her. And he continues. She's a feisty one. She got us to get our own call room. She literally spearheaded the male and female call rooms because she said she wouldn't stay with a man in the call room. So, of course, you know, you guys finish up that conversation. And then a few minutes later, when you walked over to introduce yourself to that woman, said, hi, Dr. Smith told me about you. He said that you spearheaded the male-female call room. And she replied, yeah, I did, because I was raped by a co-resident.
Yeah. And that's what I thought about myself. I was in denial about me being an addict for a long time because of what I had accomplished my whole life. But I found out in rehab that my kind of distinct character defects and strengths and weaknesses is a perfect setup for substance abuse. Namely perfectionism and, you know, depending on external validation. Those two in particular, and trying to control everything.
Yeah.
Those three is a recipe for disaster because it, you know, you might get a long way with those three and you might be successful for a long time, but it's going to catch up to most people at some point.
How do you know if it's true classic academic or not?
Yeah, it really boils down to the contract.
Okay.
So let's say you go to, we don't need to name names, but like a lot of big academic institutions have positions that are 100% clinical billable work. Okay. You're not paid to do any research or teaching or scholarship or anything with training. They might want you to do it anyways for free. That's a whole other thing. But you're 100% clinical billable. And then let's say you have a base salary. We'll just use some random numbers. Let's say you have a base salary of $300,000 a year. And if you do more than 6,000 work RVUs per year, you get a bonus of $50 per work RVU per year. You know, look, in that type of setting, regardless of the name and title on your paychecks, you're paid for your volume. You're not paid to do anything else.
So when you have a story in your brain, if you buy into it and it takes you down a spiral of doom and gloom into overwhelm, confusion, dread, and panic, it's not going to be useful for you. It's going to cause you shrunken cognitive capacity and you're not going to be able to troubleshoot the problem as easily. But if you just observe that part of yourself, you'll create some distance and then try to create new parts like certainty and curiosity and move into those parts while holding that fear part with some compassion and love.
Take a deep breath, have a sip of something, probably not coffee because that'd be after 30 patients, it'd be a lot. give them your undivided attention. Notice the color of their eyes. Ask them a little about themselves. Find out if there's a question behind the question. Try to make them laugh a little. And then finish your chart.
Because you will notice when the thing goes wrong and when you get sued, this will be happening. But just if you can hear my voice in your head telling you that you are much more than this, you are being called to defend yourself for something that happened, and you do deserve to defend yourself and you deserve to be okay. Even if something bad happens, you are going to grieve that thing and but you deserve to work through it and come back to a degree of professional courage and equanimity. And you do deserve to be joyful again and enjoy your career. But you have to remember that your career in medicine is so much more than this case. And the case itself doesn't have a lot to do with your care a lot of the time.
You gave them the value of your presence, okay? Your presence is so valuable. I don't think you realize how valuable it is. That is what people want. They want authentic presence. thank you all for listening, and thank you for joining me on this journey. It has been wonderful, I have to say, and I'm so proud of this podcast. It is truly one of a kind. I want you all to remember for 2025 that you are more than an intelligent brain and very skilled hands. Like, you are a whole human being, and you also give much more than surgery to people. You can give them your presence. That gives them value. Even though that value has not been quantified in a dollar amount, it is everything, and it is what the humans need. And so you need to take care of yourselves and recognize that you are a whole, complete human being who deserves love, safety, autonomy, and freedom. And I wish that all for all of you in 2025. Have a great week, and I will see you next week, and I will see you next year. Hey, when you got into surgery, when you were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you told yourself a story that it was going to be amazing, and it's not. That's okay. If you want to learn how to navigate the landscape of life after training, you are in luck. I have created a course just for you. It's called Empowered Surgeons Curriculum. It gives you everything you need to learn that you didn't learn in training about how to be a human in the world of surgery. All you have to do is go to courses.melthackercoaching.com/courses/empowered surgeon or click the link in the show notes. See you inside the course.